Design, the Oregon Department of Transportation. First, I would introduce Susie Jordan from the Legislative Fiscal Office and ask for her comments, if any.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At your place, I have a little packet of information that I just wanted to go through as introduction to Phase 2 for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Mainly what I wanted to touch on are the revenue sources and size of the agency budget. The first chart on page 1 is of the showing the increase in other funds. It's primarily due to the infusion of the highway revenue bonds and increases of fees. The pink color bar is the revenue bond portion of it. And then if you look across at the bottom part of the bar, the red shows an increase of over 0103 and 0305, and that is the fee increase that was adopted to support the revenue bond sale. The second page, just a note that to remind you that the highway fund is shared among the Department of Transportation, counties, and cities, and that out of the $3.9 billion to be collected in 05-07, $660.3 million is projected to accrue to other state agencies and local governments, leaving about $2 billion available for expenditure on transportation programs. The chart at the bottom of the page shows how federal funds have increased in 0103 and 0305. That was primarily due to federal participation for rail and transit programs. The decrease in federal recorded as other funds is due to planned highway transportation project construction contractor payments, the timing of that. It isn't a reduction in the amount of federal funds we're getting for highway programs, but just how our projects are going to pay out during the biennium. On page 3 is a table showing the amount of lottery funds that the department receives. All of the lottery funds that the department receives is to pay debt service on bonds for transportation projects, the Westside Light Rail Line, South Metro Commuter Rail, and Shortline Credit Program are the current bonds that are being paid with lottery funds. There's also $2.7 million included in the budget for debt service of $100 million for the Connect Oregon program, which increases to $20 million in 07-09.
Question?
Yes.
Do you know, Susie, how much of this goes into the short line credit program? Conveniently.
I can get that for
you.
I do. I have the information.
Okay, very good.
It's a small amount.
We just started, Mr. Chair.
No, we please continue.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, and the House is going to be meeting probably for another 15, 20 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good.
Who are you guys talking to?
These guys.
Oh, I guess so.
We're getting the report from LFO.
I'm doing the
overview. Oh, okay. I didn't see anyone up front. Quite a conversation you're having there.
I always talk to myself.
Yeah, when Bruce says he's behind you, he's usually waiting. Okay.
Thank you. Moving along to page 4. Is a chart showing the amount of general fund that is included in the Department of Transportation's budget. The general fund, like agencies, has decreased considerably since 1999, and this is due to reducing the rail program and finding other ways to support the passenger rail program. On page 5 are two different charts. One is a chart on the cash balances in the highway fund. This is just to show that they are increasing and that the projected cash balance is likely to be understated for several reasons and is a concern of the Legislative Fiscal Office. The current methods... The current methodology for programming projects is not making use of the current available cash. New approach of repair versus replacing bridges will result in savings adding to the ending balance. Revenues projected to be received during the biennium are not planned for expenditure in the current biennium. Cash received is used as a guide for determining contract volumes in future years. What that tells me is that the money continues to come in the door, but it's not being spent in a way that takes advantage of that current cash. The actual use of federal advanced construction funds has indicated that there is no increase in expenditure patterns, and the design-build approach should result in more project starts and completions, yet the contract volumes don't reflect that increased activity. Now, these numbers are based on the governor's recommended budget that was put together several months ago, and there have been changes in the construction payments on contracts and the addition of contracts that are going out the door. So there are some changes that are occurring that will have an impact on these bar charts, but it's still a concern to the Legislative Fiscal Office. And in talking to the co-chairs about this, we're going to ask that the department do a review of their cash management on highway construction projects during the interim and make adjustments and recommend to the emergency board or to this body what they can make to do a better job of managing that. There are a lot of factors that go into determining how much to spend on projects, and one of those factors is that the life cycle of a project expands many biennia, and so it's hard to tell just from looking at these bar charts that they aren't that they are or are not making good use of their cash. So we want to take a look at that in a little bit more detail during the interim. In 0103 on this bar chart, these are the bond proceeds that were not spent during the biennium. That's primarily the reason that is up so high. That then carries over to the next biennium where we had received the increases in the fee revenues that were adopted in 03, and they came in at a little bit higher than they expected, and the project volumes didn't keep pace, and that there are also a number of reasons why that didn't happen. And that the department expects that to occur at a faster rate now that they've got some of their systems in place, but at this point it still hasn't occurred, and so it needs to be monitored closely. And that the second chart is just another chart that shows how highway construction revenues and expenditure history kind of to show you that the expenditure history is at much less than the revenue that's coming in, and so we want to get on top of that so that we all can make some success out of these additional revenues. And then the next page, I just some of the major policy issues that the department and DAS will go over. I'm not going to spend any time on that. I just wanted to point out to you the policy issues that were dealt with during the interim. They brought 6 reports, 5 requests for federal grants, and they had 3 requests for expenditure limitation adjustments. And there were 4 audit reports. That's on page 7, and those are available online at the Secretary of State's website. That's my introduction. With that, the other things that you have attached there are the budget notes and the disposition of those budget notes, which were mainly in the form of reports to the emergency board. For your information, and then the other thing is the priorities of the subcommittee that the agency will be talking about in their presentation. With that, I would like to turn it over to Christina Shearer from Budget Management to go over the governor's.
And I will acknowledge with the arrival of Senator Johnson, the IQ of the committee just doubled.
What do you want?
The only nice thing I've ever said about you, and obviously the laughs.
I'm about ready to write it down.
Yeah. Christina, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shearer with Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. In front of you, you should have a presentation that looks something like this. The format should be familiar to you. It is the one that we use for agency presentations. Since it is familiar to you, I'm going to move fairly quickly because this is a very high-level overview, and if you have any questions, please feel free to stop me at any time. On page 2, we have the charts for the transportation program area, which is a really big program area that has 2 agencies in it, the Department of Transportation and the Department of Aviation. As you can see, the Department of Transportation more than dwarfs the Department of Aviation and is the bulk of this program area, and also is the sole recipient of general funds in this program area. The Department of Transportation's budget was allocated among all five governor's principals, or five of the governor's principals, and those are enumerated here on page 3. On page 4, you will see that the Department of Transportation's budget is $2.9 billion total funds. The bulk of that is other funds, mostly federal as other. Federal funds represent approximately 2% of the budget. Other funds non-limited is approximately 7%. General fund is $9 million, but does not represent a significant portion of the budget. And lottery funds, which as Susie's already pointed out, is for debt service, is approximately 1% of the budget. Major sources of other fund revenue besides federal as other is motor fuels and weight mile taxes and license fees. Licenses and fees. Sorry, I misspoke. Moving on to page 5. Looking at the department's budget broken down by program, you'll see by far the largest program is the highway program area, which I will go into more detail on the next slide. But there is also driver motor vehicles, motor carrier, transportation program development, public transit, rail, transportation safety, again, the lottery debt service, central services, capital improvements, capital instruction, construction, and non-limited. Also included but not shown here because I couldn't make it show up is the Board of Maritime Pilots at approximately $200,000.
Christina, mm-hmm. On the pie chart on page 5, capital construction, 9.20%.
Yes.
What is that capital construction?
Capital construction, that limitation encompasses three major programs: the completion of the Sylvan Maintenance Station, East Portland.
Okay, I got it.
You got those? Okay.
Thank you.
What's the third, Mr. Chair?
No.
It's an important one in your district.
Baker City.
In Baker City is the third, yes. Also, a small amount of planning dollars. Okay. On page 6, we're taking a closer look at the highway division, which represents $2 billion of the total funds budget. And you can see that is broken down between maintenance, preservation, bridge, highway safety, operations, modernization, special programs, local governments, and utility permits. Okay. Moving on, page 7, the department's budget broken down by budget category. Personal services represents approximately 21% of the budget. The bulk of the budget is in services and supplies, which is where all of the construction and highway operation funds are expended under the services and supplies category. Capital outlay is 1%. Special payments is 10%. And debt service, which you can't see that color differentiation, but it is about approximately 6%. On page 8, you'll see the expenditure history by fund type. There is not a significant amount of change other than an increase in general fund. That number is very large because the governor's budget includes a package for $5 million for rail. That's for two passenger train runs. And that total is $9 million. So the reason why that increase is there is just because that program is relatively small and it looks like a disproportionately large increase. Lottery funds, we're phasing in the debt service on previously issued debt issuance, and that's why that line is increasing significantly. And other funds, non-limited, is a similar situation where there's an increase in the activity in that program.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Morse?
Question. The general fund is $3.9 million in 03-05. What of that amount was for the rail, Amtrak rail service?
I believe it is all of it.
All of it?
Yes. And I just confirmed that. It is all of it.
Okay. And a follow-up. My recollection was that we had approved more than the 3.9
I believe
session.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I believe what happened in that situation, and I was not here last session, so I'm hoping ODOT will jump in, but I believe what happened is the legislature allocated part of the funds at the time the budget was passed, and the remainder was allocated to the emergency board for further allocation. Mike will clarify, because he's...
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, just to clarify...
For the record,
Mike Marsh from ODOT. The situation last time was we had a one-time fund balance in the Environmental Quality Information Fund, and that was a fund that relates to pickups, litter pickup and related activities on the highway. I had a one-time balance that the legislature determined that rather than having general fund go to this, they would take basically the entire balance of the fund out. It did not impact the program in a long-term sense, but took out all the balance of the program.
I'm still not clear. As to that backfill for the rail.
So, yes, Mr. Chair, that money, that about approximately $4.5 to $5 million ending balance that existed in that one other fund source, was taken from that fund and used for the rail program.
Ms. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, so the program was fully funded.
Right.
At that amount.
But he was just querying on the lower than... Totally.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, you're correct. There was more funded. The program was fully funded, but not with general fund.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Sorry about that. Moving into major policy issues on page 9.
The reduction in federal funds, Christina.
Reduction in federal funds. That is just a minor adjustment due to anticipated federal revenues. That federal revenue dollar changes quite often depending on the nature of projects and available grant funds. And so what you're likely seeing is a phase out of some grant. Likely there will be more grants that the agency applies for in the interim as well.
So as a snapshot, when the governor did his
yes
budget, that's really what's being reflected there.
That is correct.
Very good.
Moving on to page 9, major policy issues. As you're all aware, transportation system demands are a huge issue for this agency. Population growth and increased usage put pressure on our existing infrastructure. We've already dealt with some of that in terms of the authorization of the OTA projects. Again, those projects collectively brought approximately $3 billion for highway and bridge projects, which are currently under development or under construction in some cases, and in some cases have actually been completed. Additional projects beyond the statewide transportation improvement program is what OTIA is funding. The STIP is still in place and is continuing on as always. And as part of these projects, the department has taken on these additional construction projects without additional staffing, so they are embarking on, as you're aware, a reorganization and a change in project delivery methodology. On page 10, this project volume has put demands on their organization, and they have been redeploying staff to meet changing delivery methodologies. They have been increasing their use of contractors, which in turn places demands on their staff to manage those contracts and oversee them. The agency is dealing with aging and inflexible information systems and software, like many agencies. And the agency is also involved in the scenic project, so you're aware of that. The transportation building is another issue that the department is dealing with. It is an aging building with inadequate heating, ventilation, air conditioning, electrical, environmental, and structural systems, and several alternatives to address those issues are being explored at this time.
Does Bruce work there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, he does.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, this perhaps will be a question for Mr. Warner and his very capable staff, but in the major policy issues under organizational demands, the discussion of redeployment of staff, and you discussed moving to a model that is more contract management than, in some cases, the agency doing the work. I presume for some of the contract oversight, it takes a unique set of skills. How will that redeployment actually occur? Are there going to be people cross-trained in contract management or a different workforce? Or how do you make that move?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, your question is a good one. The simple answer is we're doing all of those.
You are?
I'm sorry, Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Excuse me. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the answer is we're doing all of those things. What I would let you know is, first off, in order to accomplish that change, and the change has been made, essentially we looked at vacancies, we held vacancies, we changed position descriptions, hired the folks that we needed to into the various positions to manage those contracts, oversee that, and we also are engaging in a training effort to cross-train and to bring new skills to the organization, a lot of them from the people that we've hired in to do some of those jobs. So it's a combination of all of the things that you described.
Thank you. As long as you're there, going to the CNIC, and I apologize that I can't remember what it's really called, Consolidated Network Information Center. That's close. That's not it, but it's close. How many people will you be giving over to that project, or how are you going to discharge ODOT's responsibilities with respect to that initiative?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, Mike came up here and we maybe give you the latest, but I believe we're still working with the Department of Administrative Services on exactly the number of employees that are going to be moving over, essentially because as we do that consolidation, we are going to be taking employees from the department and moving those positions over to the agency, whether filled positions or empty positions. We're also doing some management of positions there to look at that same thing. And maybe Mike has any...
Expecting 23... Yeah.
The reason I follow, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm curious is that two of us will deal with that issue in a morning subcommittee, and I think are still trying to completely understand how the information consolidation is going to occur, both technically and in terms of personnel and who sits where. Eventually, one would hope that there would be some savings by the consolidation and the amalgamation of these different technology functions, but that hasn't been spelled out to us with great clarity yet, so I was still trying to get a handle on how many people ODOT was offering up.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I could, I just comment that I have been intimately involved in this process all along as part of the overall governance committee of this project, and you are correct. The intent is there will be savings, and there will be clearly increased efficiencies and opportunities to do things better than we're doing now with the same or less staff. So we're looking forward to that, and obviously we know that those redeployments can be made, but as you know, they're oftentimes difficult for the employees, and so that's some of the things we're working through with that effort.
If the chair will indulge me, from your perspective, knowing as I do that you sit on the team that's putting this all together, how do you think it's going?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I would say that everybody that's at the table is engaged and is looking to make this successful. So my belief is it's moving forward, it's moving forward well. There's all sorts of implementation questions that need to be resolved, but those issues are being attacked one by one. And the latest schedule I saw showed ourselves, our department, and the other major departments that are part of that moving into the new facility quickly. So I believe we're on track and moving forward. And I think some of the questions you have about, again, ultimately the total savings, we're going to know that probably as we move actual people into the building, see the thing implemented. But sounds like you're going to get a briefing tomorrow in terms of the latest on the project. But my observation is it's moving forward, and the people who've been engaged, all the department directors, are watching it very carefully and have felt comfortable that we're going to realize savings and efficiencies.
Thank you for the interruption. Your patience.
Great. Christina?
Okay. I believe we're on page 11. We'll be looking at some of the investments made in the governor's recommended budget. First among those is the Connect Oregon package. That is $100 million in lottery-backed bonds for investment in multimodal transportation infrastructure projects. In addition, the capital construction projects that we discussed earlier with Senator Westland. The Willamette Valley Passenger Rail, as we talked about with Mike, the replacement of those funds from the one-time source back to their original funding of general fund. A federally funded program for transit vehicle replacement.
Mr. Chair. The transit vehicle replacement, that's been and perhaps maybe I'll wait until we get transit up here. I just happened to glance that way and saw transit sitting there, and I'll just wait.
Okay. The department will be talking about all of these packages in great detail in their presentation.
Thank you.
Am I on page 12? Sorry. The transportation building, there are some funds in the budget for planning related to the transportation building, and I believe we will be updating that package with a better estimate of what we're going to be looking at the next biennium. And there's a package to do some spending on some EPA requirements for maintenance stations. These are bringing maintenance stations up to standard in accordance with an agreement with the Department of Environmental Quality. There's some information technology investments in terms of infrastructure, non-scenic related infrastructure, as well as some business system support contractors. There's some workload packages related to DMV and purchasing and contracting activities. Regional trip planning, some continued investment in that program, and some transaction processing expenditures for DMV. For merchant fees and digital photo expenditures. There's fee package proposal and some ratification of fees, which we'll discuss in more detail in a couple minutes, and a couple of housekeeping packages with some reclasses that are very minor in nature. Going on to page 14, fee and revenue issues. One of the continuing issues, and again part of the reason why the OTIA projects have come into being, is that the motor fuels tax has been static. The rate has been static, and is really not keeping pace with statewide transportation improvement program requirements in order to keep the pavement at the levels we'd like to see it at. So that is a continuing issue with the agency, even with the infusion of OTIA funds. There is a proposed snow park fee increase that will provide some additional funding for some activities related to snow parks, and a ratification of several fees, including pack and load and highway approach fees, which were authorized last biennium. Rail safety oversight, which I also believe was proposed last biennium, and then two interim fees that were processed through the Senate Bill 333 process, which would be unsolicited proposal fees and a road user fee pilot program. Mm-hmm. Within an agency and a budget this large and complex, there are always technical adjustments, and we do have several for the department. We include for several position transfers between program units. We need to adjust for some change in timetables on lottery bond proceeds for Industrial Spurs and South Metro Commuter Rail. We would like to make some debt service adjustments based on some new figures from the Department of Administrative Services. We need to adjust for the November Emergency Board, and would like to convert some limited duration positions to permanent positions. An increase in the non-limited infrastructure bank. The department is also proposing to withdraw three policy packages that it no longer feels are necessary. And several of the policy packages that we've already discussed will have better and updated numbers. The department first drafted these packages back in early 2004, so for many of these packages, they're much better numbers and more accurate information that we can provide at this time. So we would like to adjust those. And finally, the department is proposing a new policy package to transfer Cape Blanco, Cape Arago Highway, and Ophir Rest Area to Oregon State Parks and Recreation. The Oregon State Parks and Recreation Department is also proposing a matching package to accomplish this transfer. Both agencies agree this would be a good move.
Great.
And that is all I have provided, unless you have any further questions.
Any questions, committee? Any questions for Susie before we move on to Director Warner? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would invite you to the dais, but or to the witness, but you're already here, so please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I was hoping we might have both houses present to talk with you, to talk about our review of the priorities. And this part of the agenda, my role, and
Bruce,
I'm sorry.
The reason I started this was out of courtesy for you guys. Do you want to hold just a little bit?
Mr. Chair, no. I
would be here 15 minutes ago, so.
No, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move on and get you the information we need to allow you to start deliberating and make some decisions on our budget, because I think you need to get into the meat of the individual division budgets, and hopefully they will be here when we get into that time period.
Very good. Please proceed.
All right. My role, which is the start of this Phase 2 Ways and Means, is to respond to the committee's ranking of the priority issues and programs and activities of the department. And I would call your attention, I believe Ms. Jordan put at the back of your her presentation, the list of the priorities that were ranked by all of the members of the Joint Committee. And before I respond to your committee's review of these items, I would like to acknowledge the effort that went into this ranking and review of the department's various programs. I think applying the new Ways and Means process was a learning experience for all of us, and in retrospect, I think the department could have helped you and your staff a little more by maybe consolidating some of these things into the like programs to, quite frankly, reduce the sheer number of the activities and programs. But I look forward to again, working on this in the future, because I think it's a good process to get everybody acquainted with the department and the activities that we have.
Perfect. Mr. Warner just started.
Okay.
So Mr. Chair, I'm just again beginning to go over my review of the committee's review of our priority programs and activities. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time to go through all of those and rank them all. And I did find your rankings instructive and helpful to me in terms of understanding your thought process in our budget. So my overall response to your work and the efforts that are shown on these ranking sheets was that, first off, I believe there's a general agreement with the department's original rankings, but there were some minor differences. My review of the rankings that you show me here show me that the committee's priorities continue to center around our construction program, safety, mobility, and revenue collection. And your top priority, clearly the top priorities of the committee and ours, is our construction program and obviously the related job creation benefits and providing a transportation system adequate to support the state's economic growth and livability. So if you look at the priorities that you've done, and you combine all of the highway construction programs together and then look at probably the next seven or eight so of the priorities until you hit the first two by one of the committee members, that accounts for almost half of our entire budget. So, again, I think we are consistent and in agreement in terms of where the major priorities should be for the department. What I see from that point on, where you hit the first two, is that that's where the variation occurs. I believe that we ranked our maintenance programs a bit higher than you had ranked them, and various programs in our maintenance portions of our budget have been ranked in various priorities throughout the remaining activities on those charts. And what your ranking showed is that the rail crossing safety, rail safety in general, special needs transportation, work zone enforcement, our fuel tax collection, equipment storage at Sandingham Junction, and debt service moved above our maintenance programs, which, again, I think is instructive, and I'm glad that the committee is looking at those areas. But, again, clearly, as we agreed in our Phase 1 presentation, the debt service, as an example, is one that should have ranked higher in our initial cut at priorities, because we do have to pay for those bonds and the monies that we have borrowed. And you remember that Representative Richardson pointed this out to us. And I think the other thing that the ranking by the committee shows that it is, again, the highway construction program of the local governments should also be ranked higher than we have. And then finally, if you start going down the list of priorities, I did notice that some of the individual maintenance programs, such as the youth litter and the operations and permit activities, dropped quite a bit in the committee's rankings. And I think that's probably one of the areas you want to have a dialogue about when we get into the highway division's programs. Mm-hmm. I also saw that some of the traffic safety programs were ranked lower by your review. So, again, my assessment is that there's minor differences in our rankings of the department programs, but for the most part, we seem to be in sync about where the priorities are for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I do hope that if some of the lower rankings are as a result of questions or concerns about a specific program or activity, that these issues can be addressed by the folks who are going to be following me, the individual division managers, as they go through their individual presentations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Bruce, I was just curious, and this puts you on the spot. You have been, I think, a very faithful reporter just now of what you saw. Did any of the rankings really surprise you? And you look at them and think, what were those people thinking?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the obviously ones that caught my attention probably the most were some of the traffic safety issues. In other words, some of the programs that we have where we're providing funds and training and operation of committees to further traffic safety and eliminate the fatalities and injuries on our state's highways and roads. I was surprised that some of those were rated as low as they were. So those are the ones that stuck out to me the most in the issue. In terms of maintenance, I think there's some misunderstanding of some of the things that we do in the maintenance, and I'm hoping some of those things that were rated low in maintenance, we can get to some of the questions to maybe understand why some of those are rated. So traffic safety and some of the maintenance activities were the two areas that I saw.
Have you instructed Troy and your other staff to comment on that when we come to their individual programmatic areas, or will they just wait questions from us?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I have not prompted them to do that, but since you say that, and I think you've already put them on notice that we should proactively touch on that in our presentations today.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
One thing I want to point out, both for the committee and for Director Warner, is as you look at the priority listings, I'm not sure that the numerous projects that average to one or any type of priority order, but rather are listed by their department number. And so, for example, if you look at debt service, that averaged to one but is on page 205, mm-hmm. it's because its department number was 100 and not department number one, as you would have seen in the highway construction projects on page one.
Right.
And so this committee didn't get into the finite detail of prioritizing from one to, in this case, I think 100.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I think that's a good example, though, where the debt service, as you point out, was number 100 on our priority list, when in actuality we can't escape that. That's money we have to spend, so it should have been the number one priority in our original. So I agree with the committee and what they did there.
Oh, I see.
Again, I know we provided you a ton of information in our phase one presentations, and I think this work has set the stage very well for phase two. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, really I have nothing more to say, and that would conclude my review of the priorities, other than, again, just I want to thank you folks for taking the time to look at those, because I think it did bring up some of the issues that we need to focus in on our presentations, and I was remiss by not having my managers just focus on that, and we'll make sure that they do. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions from the committee.
Any questions? Don't see any. I would like to take a moment, though, and thank Susie for putting this together in the way that she did. I find it very helpful to see how the members rank these in our initial. And so I appreciate that. Thank you. So where do we want to go now? We're going to go to update on performance measures.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mike Myers from ODOT to do that. The members should have a form that looks like this, a replacement page 33. And Susie, I don't know if it's actually at each member's place or needs to be distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like they've got it on place. Okay, thank you. And we discussed in phase one the performance measures for the department. The one area that we do have an adjustment on relates to one of the key performance measures that was requested for adjustment, and that's number one on this new replacement page 33 dated May 9th. And the discussion we had in phase one was around the issue of bike lanes and how we do measurement as it relates to bike lanes and sidewalks and what we do, what our focus is, and what we want to see change. The concern was that the old measure, which you can see there is listed as bike lanes and sidewalks percent of urban state highway miles with bike lanes and sidewalks, we want to change that to bike lanes and sidewalks percent of urban state highway miles with bicycle and pedestrian facilities in fair or better condition. And the idea is to make sure that we're focusing on system condition for bike and pedestrian facilities, keeping in mind we call it bike and pedestrian, but really 90% of the funds go to the sidewalks and pedestrian element of those two alternatives. What we're shifting to here is trying to make sure that we've got a way to determine not only the existence of a facility, but also whether it's in appropriate condition or not. And so that's the change that we're making. We have discussed that change with the Progress Board. They concur with the adjustment that we're recommending here and wanted to make sure that you have the exact wording for the adjustment that has been completed within the last several weeks. So, Mr. Chair, we're adding that to what was in the prior list of key performance measures. If there are any questions about the what or why relating to the bike and ped program or this measure, we're open.
Senator Johnson.
With your permission, Mr. Chair, I want to take a little tiny side trip before we come back to this. I should know the answer to my question. I don't. Under what circumstances are you, the department, required to accommodate bikes? Does every project have a bike component now, or does it come from a pent-up demand from biking interests, or does it depend on the type of the road? I just simply don't know.
It's a good question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it is a good question. Under state law, we're required to, whenever we do an improvement of a highway, to essentially provide bike and pedestrian facilities, unless we have determined that, number one, the cost is excessive. Or in other words, you can't. You know, at the coast is an example where if you want to add on, you essentially get into the wetlands, very very expensive. Can't
right of way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the cost of the program. So and the demand is not there. So there's outs in the legislation that says that allows us to not proceed with a bike or pedestrian facility on a new project. But I think if you look at most of the projects we do, especially the modernization projects. For the most part, they all have bike or pedestrian facilities along with them. In the rural areas, as we do major pavement maintenance preservation, if we have the right-of-way, as you know, we also try to widen the shoulders, provide a standard bike path that would benefit, again, tourism, especially on some of those routes. The law also requires we and cities and counties to expend not less than 1% of their highway revenues generated from the State Highway Trust Fund on bike and pedestrian facilities. And so those monies are used for that purpose that augment the projects, and there's some standalone projects, mostly pedestrian facilities, that are filling in the missing links on our facilities, if I'm being responsive to your question.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
You are. The thing that I'm wrestling with is those instances where there is a push to put a bike lane in, where there's an equally hard push saying this would impede the flow of freight. What springs immediately to my mind is the St. John's Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where the dynamic occurs that debates whether or not that's a good thing, where the freight folks have a chance to come forward and say, this really doesn't work for us. The bike folks come through and say, getting a chance to ride across the Willamette River is a very big deal and we need to have this. Where does that table occur where those discussions happen? And then ultimately, who's the authority to say, yes, this will happen or no? I think I'm looking at him. Yes, this will happen or no, this won't happen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you have the authority correct. It is the department who would make the decision in term, and ultimately the commission in terms of appeal on whether a project has a bike facility or you change the facility, add a bike facility. What those decisions are made during a project development process. We try our darndest to get the right stakeholders in the room to talk about the design and what a project looks like. St. John's Bridge is a great example where we invited everybody in, the bike interests, the freight interests, the city, the county, and essentially made a decision that we were not going to add, essentially reduce a number of travel lanes and restripe the bridge so that you had on-street or on-roadway bike paths. As you would imagine, some people were not very pleased with that decision, but that's a decision that we said we needed to make from the standpoint of freight and the overall function of traffic on that bridge. I also believe the discussion is probably not dead, because I think we will probably have further discussions, and we've already had dialogues with the interests and with Federal Highway about is their ability to get monies to do, for example, a pathway underneath the bridge, as an example. So there's all sorts of things you can do that can accommodate them. But on that particular project, the decision was made as part of the project development decisions that here's what the configuration of the roadway would be. And then obviously if people don't like that, they can appeal to the commission. And in some cases, as you know, people have taken it to the courts to say that it wasn't adequate and you need to follow the law and didn't do as good a job of making the findings to substantiate the decision. But in that case, like most others, we do the due diligence and make the decision in an informed manner by involving all the parties up front. Doesn't mean everybody's happy when we get done.
One more,
please.
I'm just also trying to understand the dynamic in a cost-benefit ratio. That's an old bridge. It's just now, I'm using it as an example, undergone a substantial facelift. And when you talk about slinging a bike lane underneath that bridge, it boggles the mind to think about the engineering that must be involved in that and how it is when we have capacity problems and people's perception of you're doing this level of accommodation for a bike lane and I'm parked for 5.5 hours on the Sunset trying to get out to 185th. How that both the cost-benefit ratio of actually doing the engineering to physically accommodate hanging it under the St. John's versus the public education piece of trying to understand that this isn't just government arbitrarily deciding they're going to do X, Y, and Z, but that there is a process that yields these rather complex decisions, because I don't think a lot of people get it. And believe me, I'm making no case for anybody in spandex. I have a natural aversion to people that wear spandex.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, excuse me, I'm going to try to compose myself here. First off, I want to be clear, we are not committed to a project place a bike path under the St. John's Bridge. I'm saying those dialogues and discussions are going on. And what you're describing is in order to have that project bump up to a standpoint where it would be funded, there needs to be a lot of dialogue with the region, the city, and state about priorities, about where those money should go. There are certain pots of federal dollars that can be used for these kind of projects, and we do a solicitation, on an annual or biennial basis to look at projects which should compete. But in the case of the bike path on the St. John's, just like a bike path anyplace else, they have to compete against the others, and we look at the benefits and costs and the traffic and again the amount of folks that would use it, try to make sure that our money is going to the best possible facility. But again, as you know, there's winners and losers on those, and again, my push is to get people involved with those efforts, because I think if they're involved, they will understand the issues that we're talking about and will also have an opportunity to weigh in and have themselves heard as we move forward in project selection.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. I did want to mention that in terms of cost-benefit analysis and Senator Johnson's question, the fact of the matter is that the weights on the different variables on cost-benefit analysis end up being different between the state and local government. So many times it's the match that occurs from the local government to say this is more important to us than it is to you, and that makes up for that weighting in terms of things happening that maybe we wouldn't see on a statewide basis.
How do you balance that with a rural community, any rural community outside of my district that wants to do a bike or a pedestrian path, and you look at the cost of it, and you know that you're in a community of 500 people? How do you help me figure out how that decision making goes, knowing that the same project in Bend, in Portland,
In Bend, it's a good project.
Kill them up.
Mr. Chair, as I said, those are the exact kind of dialogues and discussions we have at the project development side. When we start actually scoping the project out, we try to involve the cities, the county, the rural folks. And in many cases, some of those rural areas say we don't want those facilities. They don't make sense. They don't link up to any other.
And the statute allows you to do that.
The statute allows us to do that. It also allows us to to deal with the needs. And some of those rural communities, we want, from the standpoint of tourism and other things, we want to have safe, you know, places for bikes to be. So there's always that push and pull. But I think when you look at the overall, we're doing a pretty good job of trying to meet people's needs and put the monies where they're desired and do the most good. It doesn't. We definitely don't want to build them places where people are not going to use them or don't want them.
I appreciate that. In your earlier comments, I think I missed the fact you have a little bit of latitude in that statute.
Mr. Chair, unless there are questions, we're ready to move on to the presentations by divisions.
Did we talk about the fish passage?
That one did not change, Mr.
That
Chair.
That did not change. Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, why don't we proceed forward then?
Okay. You want to introduce them?
Where are we now? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You folks are. We are going to ask Susan Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to step away from the table to make room for the two Board of Maritime Pilot folks here.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming to the committee, the agency will be working from their presentation document that they provided you in the last, in phase one. The binders at your place are the budget documents, just for your reference.
Welcome. If you could introduce yourselves for the record.
My name is Katie Eyman, and I'm chair of the Board of Maritime Pilots. My last name is spelled E-Y-M-A-N-N.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Johnson. For the record, I am the administrator for the Board of Maritime Pilots.
Welcome. We'll let you folks begin.
All right. The Board of Maritime Pilots was established in 1846 to help protect public safety by ensuring that only the best qualified persons are licensed to pilot commercial vessels upon the waters of the state of Oregon. The Board is an occupational licensing and regulatory agency for the state pilots who provide local navigational and ship handling expertise.
Mr. Chair.
Sandra Johnson.
It's a little early for a question, but I got one. You all are not the credentialing agency, are you? I mean, if someone is expecting to bring commerce across the bar or up the Columbia River, they would have certain industry credentials, would they not, that are then presented to you, or do you independently test skills and credential pilots?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the board is the occupational licensing and regulatory agency for state maritime pilots. We are one of 23 maritime states that regulates the pilots that bring in commercial shipping off the ocean and into the waters of the state.
Right, I understand that. But if I show up on your doorstep wanting to be a bar pilot, I have certain industry recognized certifications and credentialing that exists. You're not issuing these licenses. I come to you with credentials and present them for your inspection for their degree of satisfaction. You're not testing pilots or doing any proficiency-based assessments, are you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I understand what you're saying, the individuals that come to be licensed by the state do have credentials that they receive from the federal government, the United States Coast Guard?
That's what I'm getting at. My industry is all aviation. The federal government gives me a pilot's license. If I want to go to work for a state agency flying fire suppression, I come and I present my FAA, Federal Aviation Administration issued credential, and I say the FAA has deemed me competent to discharge this work. And the state agency then looks at my credential and says, yeah, you got one, and that's that. What I'm trying to establish are to what degree of competency, certification, oversight, pilots present themselves to your board, and you either do independent testing or you look at their credentials and say, yep, you got one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, from the state's perspective, federal qualifications are for minimal competency, and from the state's point of view, minimal competency is not good enough.
OK, Okay, so what do you do to fill that gap between minimal competency issued by the feds and superior competency expected by Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it's the board's role to establish the qualifications for optimal competency.
Mr. Chair, please. Okay, you establish items 1 through 10 for optimal competency, and someone presenting their credentials to you has gone someplace else, has been a captain, has crossed so many bars, has done something, and then they come and they meet those minimum standards in Oregon.
If I could answer, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, while I don't have the list right in front of me, we require a federal license. We require things that they can get externally, so many years of being a master unlimited. In addition, they have to go through an interview with us where we ask them competency-based questions, give them scenarios where they have to answer about how they would perform in a particular situation, and we have pilots and industry members and public members on that committee. So they actually go through a testing process, and then they get a rating, and they get a score, and then we tally the scores, and the top people on after they've gone through this process of interviewing and testing then are hired. So a person cannot just go to an external place, get points, and then come to us and say, see, I've gotten it. No, the board, and to its designees, is responsible for selecting and scoring potential pilots. And then after they are selected, they have to go through an apprenticeship time where they have to cross or use the ground so many times. And if they do not do that satisfactorily, then they may not be granted their license. They're tentative, so to speak, while they go through a training period. And Susan may want to correct some details of what I just told you. Thank you. Is there any correction? I'm not.
No. Senator Johnson, okay. Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah. What special qualifications do the public members of the board have to assess whether or not someone is competent to bring cargo up the channel in the Columbia River?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the public members of the board do not assess the competency of the individuals who are training for license. It is the pilots that assess the competency of the individuals and make recommendations to the board.
One more follow-up. So then in your interview process, Ms. Iman just suggested that you have your public members, your industry folks. Do the public members participate in any of the interviewing or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, one public member, usually part of a three-member team, including a pilot member and a steamship operator member, participate in the interviews of our applicants. They do not conduct a competency test at that time. It's merely an interview to go over their qualifications, to get a sense of the individual, where they're coming from. It's all part of a ranked system that we use to qualify the applicants.
Would you mind, just for my own amusement, if you will, to provide me with a qualification list of what it takes to become a maritime pilot? I have to tell you, as a young boy watching commercial boats come across Barview Jetty, as a young kid, I was always intrigued with it, and now I'd be really interested in seeing what it takes to qualify. I imagine it's a very skilled occupation.
That's true, Mr. Chair. What most people, or the layperson probably, does not understand is that a maritime pilot is the apex, it's the height of a maritime career. This is not something that you start out, learning at the beginning. You start at the bottom rung and you work your way up the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And so for candidates in the state of Oregon, the minimal competency is 2 years as master of a vessel, and you have to have, depending on where you're getting your license, you have to have experience upon the grounds for which you're applying for license. And, for example, for the Columbia River, that's years worth of experience.
Yeah, I would just appreciate if you'd send that to me. I'd share with the committee as well. I've been invited to take a helicopter ride, and then they drop you not literally, but drop you onto the boat as they bring you in. I just have to admit I'm not man enough to try it quite yet.
That is some of the most, this is speaking with 20 years of experience and 3,500 hours as a helicopter pilot, that is some of the most demanding, rigorous flying that exists in the world. They are literally flying out, placing a bar pilot onto the deck of a ship at sea at all times of the day and night. The winch person has remarkable skill. The pilots are simply unparalleled in their skill. The machine is exactly the right kind of machine to do this kind of work. And it's my personal opinion, from having observed the operation and knowing as much as I know about it from my professional background, that it is a huge safety margin to be able to put the pilots on farther out at sea. You should do it. It is a remarkable experience.
Maybe in the summer.
Yeah, maybe in the summer on a calm day, no wind, right. In the day.
No November landing.
No wave.
That's right. I'm sorry, we've digressed on you. If you could take your presentation
right.
And go.
I guess I'll start off where I left off. The board is an occupational licensing and regulatory agency for the state pilots who provide local navigational and ship handling expertise. Maritime pilots and steamship operators are among the major transporters of goods, products, and materials in the state. The pilotage grounds on which they work are an integral, albeit unacknowledged, part of Oregon's transportation infrastructure. The agency is currently staffed by one FTE administrator, that would be me, and the board's authority and responsibilities reside within ORS Chapter 776 and OAR Chapter 856.
Do you have any administrative assistance?
Mr. Chair, no, sir.
Well, you're pretty cheap, aren't you, Bruce? Why don't we keep going?
I would like to direct your attention to page 3, where I'll go over the board's core activities, establishing license requirements for pilots, including minimum standards for education, training, health, and continuing professional development, processing applications, qualifying applicants, and interviewing and selecting pilot trainees, providing for license examinations and issuing new and renewal licenses, fixing the rates that licensees can charge for their services. The board is only one of two state agencies involved in the complexities of rate setting, and conducting investigations of maritime incidents involving licensees.
You do all of that.
Mr. Chair, yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, could
Senator
I follow
Johnson.
Up?
Recently there was a tragic airplane accident, and the pilot was killed. The NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, shows up on site, and they are there with the FAA, mechanics that are hired by the FAA, technical people from the National Transportation Safety Board, and they do the inspection and try to determine the cause of the crash. Could you walk us through a scenario? Recently in the channel, we had a ship run aground. Could you walk us through the role that you all play, and who are the technical experts that show up as soon as the call comes at 4:30 in the morning? Walk us through what happens.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it depends on the severity of the incident. Referring to a casual grounding in the Columbia River, a call to the pilot member of the board that serves that ground would be taken, and he would initiate the investigation. And depending upon the severity of the incident, he may call in two additional board members to co-investigate the incident with him.
Mr. Chair.
Or her.
Please.
Two additional board members. This would be like the public board member?
A public board member and an industry board member.
To what degree does the public board member make any contribution to the investigation? What do they know about steering mechanisms in big ships or channel configuration or weather? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, some of our public members actually have learned quite a bit during their stints on the board, and to the extent that they only have limited knowledge and expertise in this area, certainly they can be assured of the integrity of the investigation and their participation.
How often does your board meet?
I just wanted to follow up on that question, Mr. Chair, if I could. Senator Johnson, we, prior to statutory change. We had a fund for a private investigator to help us, an expert investigator to investigate these things, but because of a statutory change which didn't let us reimburse ourselves for the cost of rate hearings, we had to use that fund. So we don't currently have a fund for an investigator, and we'd like to see a rate increase for our fees in order to establish the fund for a private investigator for the major incidences. And also, while an incident is occurring, there's the parallel incident investigation by the Coast Guard, and we coordinate with the Coast Guard and do a parallel investigation.
Really quick, I want to ask one question. How often does your board meet?
Mr. Chair, typically once a month.
Okay, thank you. Senator Johnson.
I'm just trying to understand. Forgive me if I heard the wrong word. But for those of us that live along the Columbia, what constitutes a trivial grounding? Maybe you didn't use the word trivial, but it seemed a little dismissive of a grounding.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I never used such a word. The word is casual grounding.
Sorry.
And that does not refer to the fact that it's either trivial or inconsequential. It just refers to the nature of the grounding itself, the outcome. Meaning the vessel probably fetched up on a shoal. The vessel did not have any hull breach or, you know, something of that nature. There was no damage to the environment. There were no injuries or of anything of that nature.
How frequently does that happen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, not very often. Last year we had 3 reported groundings.
Three reported. Is there a requirement that any grounding be reported?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we have very strict requirements for reporting incidents.
I can answer that question a little better, Mr. Chair. When your yacht goes ashore, that's a casual grounding. When my yacht goes ashore,
that's an incident.
We're in a jovial mood today, so please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to refer you now to our budget detail on page 8. The agency is funded solely by license fees. I'm tripping over my tongue. Which have not been statutorily increased in 14 years. The 2005-2007 budget request is the smallest operating budget for this agency in nearly as many years and represents a 23% decrease from the current biennium. In order to maintain operations within this budget, we will need to cut costs with some combination in reduction of staff time, board and committee meetings, and assistant attorney general fees. Even with these cost-cutting measures, the board will be unable to maintain financial stability at this level of funding, and we will request a license fee increase in the near future. When the board conducts rate hearings, the parties are assessed in the cost of the proceedings as part of a final order. However, the agency must pay those costs before we can recover any reimbursement. Because of this, the board finds it prudent to keep at least 3 months' worth of operating expenses as an ending balance. With respect to our performance measures on pages 5 and 6...
Before we move off of that, let me begin by saying, Director Warner, I was just teasing. I joke with those who I like. So, really quick, you're in other funds.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Budget and fee-driven.
Correct.
Are you able to share with us a little bit, and we're not a revenue committee, but I just want to have a good understanding about this. What fees are paid to the state of Oregon? How does that work?
And Mr. Chair, the licensees that we license, the pilots, pay a $1,500 annual license fee, and that is our sole source of funding.
Is that per pilot?
Per pilot.
And how much I didn't hear?
$1,500. Do the pilots serve as contractors or employees of companies?
Mr. Chair, pilots are quasi-public servants. They are independent contractors, but they are licensed and regulated by the state.
Just help me here. I just want some background information on this. Who issues their check, their paycheck?
Mr. Chair, pilots associate into organizations or associations similarly to what you might see in a doctor's office where doctors come together into a place and they share fees and expenses, and then they share the revenues from their operation, and that's how the pilots operate.
And one last quick question. How many pilots do we have then, licensed pilots?
Mr. Chair, currently we have 67 licensees.
That's it.
Yes, sir.
How do you keep going on 67 licenses of 1,500?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to think that we're very resourceful.
Must be. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Absent the oversight of the state of Oregon, I mean, 67, these are pretty closed guilds, ostensibly. I mean, one could characterize. Obviously, you take exception. Correct me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by a closed guild.
This is a very small group of people that are credentialed other places. And I'm just trying to figure out, if they were not credentialed by the state of Oregon, what would be the most serious downside? The point I'm trying to make is, with 67 of them, they all know each other. They've worked together in some cases. This is a pretty small universe of people engaged in a highly skilled activity that has been years in the making. And this for many of these folks represents the culmination of a career on the ocean. I'm just trying to figure out, were your board not checking their credentials on entry into Oregon, what would be the worst outcome?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the states, all of the states, maritime states, license and regulate their pilots because the federal government defers to the states to license and regulate state pilots. So if a state decides no longer to maintain oversight over those pilots, then the federal government would take over.
And what would be the upside and the downside of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I believe the downside would be that the state would lose their say in any situation of happenings that occur in the state.
Lose their say with respect to what?
Would you like to answer that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the reason the states have control over licensing of pilots is because pilots, while they may be very skilled in oceans all over the world, need to know the specific turns and of a navigation turns of a particular route, or, you know, channel. The state is the body that knows that at the most. This board is the oldest board that it exists in the state of Oregon. We were the first commissioner board that was established. The reason for that is because the Columbia River is sometimes called the graveyard of the Pacific, and it wasn't interested in just when they set up this board for the purpose of getting a license fee and paying an administrator. It was for the purpose of making sure that any person navigating a vessel across the Columbia Bar and up the Columbia River knows exactly what that requires. So by us being, if the federal government had to come in, they would be basically duplicating our procedure to make sure that the people that are licensed to be on that ground are qualified, and that's what the procedure we have does.
Mr. Chair, but you're not teaching them how to navigate the channel. You're making sure that they know how to navigate the channel.
Right, and we say what our board, so its criteria says what is required for us to know that they are qualified. We determine what is qualified.
One last vote. But in the absence of a Oregon State Board of Maritime Pilots, the feds would discharge that responsibility of making sure that pilots coming up the river knew how to do it.
I'm not sure what the consequence would be, Mr. Chair, Senator John. I'm not sure exactly how it would work. I just know what we have.
Thank you.
I want to follow up on that question. When I hear up the river, I'm assuming from the Willamette River up.
And I'm,
yeah, I'm from Eastern Oregon. Are our upland river pilots, are they part of this?
Mr. Chair, the pilots navigate all the way up to Pasco, Washington, sometimes beyond.
So Burner, Tidewater.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Those pilots are part of this.
No, but a lot of our pilots come from those companies.
So who regulates, let's say, burner barge lines from Portland up to Lewiston Clarkson area? Who?
Mr. Chair, the United States Coast Guard regulates the licensing for the individuals that navigate those vessels up there.
Okay. Thank you. Can we continue on?
Oh, that's right. I'm doing a presentation. All right. I was up to performance measures. I refer you now to pages 5 and 6, where we have listed three performance measures related to maritime pilot diversity. They were so recently approved, in fact, that there is nothing to report at this time, and at this point we are monitoring the data we collect. As you can see, with such a small program and staff, and given the funding level, we are unable to take proactive measures to further the goals. And finally, regarding the proposed legislation on page 7, as it turns out, that concept did not materialize. However, two bills have been introduced this session that directly affect the board's statute, House Bill 2090 and House Bill 3257. The proposed legislation does not appear to have any fiscal impact. And that finally concludes my presentation, and we'd be happy to entertain any more questions.
How do you control the percent of qualified maritime pilots or the applicant pool? How do you control the percent of the qualified maritime pilot applicant pool that are women or minorities?
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question, because we really have no influence over the makeup of the applicant pool.
Is this a performance measure that we need to get rid of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Representative Smith, this is a measure that the last legislative body directed the agency to create, because there is such a lack of minority participation in the pilot program. The purpose of the measure was to find ways to make changes in that by focusing on minorities.
It isn't mine, but it Captain Dempsey is one. How many women are there now in this cadre of 67 pilots?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we have two women and one Native American.
Okay. The issue here, I think, is still over control for the state. You cannot go out and just out of whole cloth create people that represent certain classes. They come with this high level of credential, and they either have it or they don't have it, and the universe is very small. I'd be curious to know what the board has done to try to encourage women and minorities to come into the profession. But as you already alluded to, in many cases, people start their careers down on the tugboats and work up through to this advanced level of certification, and I don't know where the board has engaged in encouraging women and minorities.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the board has engaged in a number of outreach activities. Our pilot members are also engaged in outreach activities. They go to schools. They go to career fairs. They give topical presentations for marine boating, recreational boating classes. I have a whole litany of exercises that our membership has been through to try and promote the occupation and get the people into the applicant pool that we'd like to see better represented.
As long as this is part of your performance measure, maybe you could bring us that recitation of the presentations and give them to the professional staff.
I'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the agency did make a report, I believe, in just this last interim on this subject, and has that report did include a list of those activities that they're doing.
Great.
So I could get that to the committee.
That would be terrific.
I'm going to share my personal bias with the committee while we're here. As you folks know, I've been pretty adamant that we make sure that all Oregonians have an opportunity in the state of Oregon. I'm struggling with this performance measure, however, for two reasons. One, you're dealing with private industry. And two, I think this is truly, with the resources that these folks have available to them, completely beyond their control. So I struggle with this one, and I'm not sure where I want to go with this yet, but I think I'd ask the committee to think about this, and between now and round three, let's take a look at this, because I'm not sure how you have any influence on this. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Would you mind detailing your Attorney General expenditures seem very high as a ratio of the budget of the whole board. Could you talk a little bit about why you're incurring such high AG fees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, a lot of that activity is a function of the activities of the people we regulate and our constituents as a whole. Oftentimes they come to us with requests for declaratory rulings to interpret the tariff or the statute. A lot of it is attributable to our Assistant Attorney General's involvement in rate proceedings, of which we've just concluded one, and a second one is close to conclusion within the next couple of months. So those fees do fluctuate, but they are a function of the legal activity that we're faced with from year in, year out.
With regard to the contested rate cases, how many rate cases have you done in the last decade? And I shouldn't catch you that unawares with that question, but maybe you could get back to us. How many you've done in the last decade, how many were contested? And what I'm trying to get a flavor for is that those contested case hearings end up costing somebody a pile of money. And whether it's the pilots or the shippers, all of that ends up in a universe of costs. And what I'm trying to figure out is whether or not the board has been proactive at all in looking at how those costs, the whole universe of costs, could be ameliorated in order to keep the costs of the use of the Port of Portland down. I don't have evidence right in front of me, but I have heard anecdotally that pilotage costs for the port and all of the attendant expenses are driving the costs up to a point where we already have to recognize that that port is 90 miles inland, and to keep it a viable port. I'm just curious what the board has done to try to mitigate the cost of the contested case hearings and how proactively you all have been engaged in trying to hold the whole universe of costs down.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I could respond to that question. When I first came onto the board, it was at the decision point of a contested rate hearing with the bar pilots, and every rate hearing since it has gone to contested case has been with the bar pilot organization. The one before the last one, there was quite a lot of requests. For instance, there was a request for a new building and a new helipad at the Port of Astoria, and this came out of the blue. So immediately after that rate hearing, we instituted rules that require that if there's going to be any kind of capital expenditure like that, that the board be given notice of it beforehand, and we have a chance to be more like a legislative body, hear about it, as opposed to only finding out about it in the middle of a contested case. And at that point, the board was completely excluded from contested cases, so we were more like judges as opposed to a legislative body like you are, hearing proposals and hearing the whys and wherefores. So we have instituted rule changes to request that parties, if they know an issue is going to come up, let us know. And we also have mandatory mediation. As soon as they have to give us notice that they're going to file a contested case, a rate increase, then we go into a mandatory mediation where the board works with the parties to get it resolved. And they have to participate in that process to get the case resolved with the public members, because it's frankly it's public members who are the final decision makers of the case anyway. So we worked very hard to lower the cost of rate hearings, and that was successful with the river pilots this last time. Currently, we are in a contested rate case. The parties are in a contested rate case that will come regarding the rate for the bar, the Columbia River Bar Pilots Thank Association.
You. Thank you. We're going to need to get moving on here.
Yes, sir.
Any other thoughts you'd like to share with us?
Mr. Chair, I think I've said enough today.
I want to just go back very quickly to the performance measures, and I'm going to turn to Senator Johnson on this, as this I think primarily affects your area. My understanding on this, in order to get your license, you have to go through an apprenticeship process?
Mr. Chair, there is a training process that all licensees go through, and it's dependent upon the ground that they're training for. So,
But in order to get the hands-on experience, you're going to have a company willing to sign on and let you come out to get that experience, I assume.
Mr. Chair, that would be coming into the pilots, getting licensed by the Board of Maritime Pilots. That would be part of the path of a maritime career.
Okay, let me turn to Senator Johnson really quick on the performance measure. Again, this primarily affects you, and so I will defer to you. I'm not sure this is a performance measure that tells us anything. I'm not sure if we should be looking at license renewals, training, maritime incident investigation, something that lets us know that the Board of Maritime Pilots is performing a function that we would have it perform.
I would concur with the chair, and I think rather, given the shortness of the time than working this here, that we may have the opportunity to visit with this panel one more time before the committee takes any action, and we have a chance to chat with them offline about what might be a better measure.
Would you be okay with me directing them to think through that?
Sure.
And to be prepared to come back to us in round three with a performance measure that perhaps makes more sense to this committee and to you in terms of helping us understand your overall responsibilities and helping us determine the success at meeting those.
Great.
Would that be right?
Sounds great.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to move on, and we're going to ask Greg. Come on up, and we're going to go to the Motor Carrier Transportation Program Summary and Policy Package Review. I think we can get through this in about 10 minutes.
Everyone at ODOT is wondering if I can get through this in 10 minutes.
Well, take your best shot.
Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Greg Delfani. I'm the administrator for the Motor Carrier Division. And though time is short, I want to take just a couple of seconds and say that Benjamin Franklin once said that well done is better than well said. And I'm going to describe for you some things that have been done well. But at the outset, I want to give credit and acknowledge the men and women that work at the Motor Carrier Transportation Division who work on the front lines that are responsible for the good things I'm going to talk about. The Motor Carrier Transportation Division helps truckers comply with Oregon state laws and federal laws and regulations regarding truck size and weight, safety, registration, highway use tax, and economic regulations. The statutes that I refer to are in ORS Chapters 803, 818, 825, 826, and Administrative Rule Chapters 734 and 740. We have a current staffing of 320 FTE that are basically divided into four service groups that are detailed on the bottom of page one. I'm going to describe for you quickly the content of those four service groups, and then I'll briefly explain the work that's done after I list them. Within Salem Motor Carrier Services Work Group, we have commercial vehicle registration. This applies to commercial vehicles in Oregon operating over 26,000 pounds. Highway use tax collection, referring to the collection of weight mile tax. The issuance of over-dimension permits and economic regulation, in which we're looking at motor carriers that are hauling passengers or household goods. Investigation, safety, and federal programs includes, as the name implies, enforcement of commercial vehicle and driver safety enforcement rules, and it also has oversight for the green light program, which I'll explain in greater detail in the presentation. Field Carrier Services is responsible largely for the regulation of truck size and weight and also the provision of registration services at several field locations. Finally, the Motor Carrier Audit Work Group is responsible for the conduct of audits for weight mile tax, registration fees through the International Registration Plan and the International Fuel Tax Agreement as well. In terms of service delivery, we regulate a very diverse motor carrier industry. We deal with almost 26,000 registered motor carriers operating a combined fleet of in excess of 300,000 registered vehicles. We offer over-the-counter registration service Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, in the Salem headquarters, at a Portland office located at Jansen Beach, and at three ports of entry located in Ashland, Farewell Bend, and Umatilla. We also have a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week service center, also located here in Salem. An increasing number amount of our business is conducted via trucking online. This is something that I would emphasize for the committee. This is really a remarkable service provision. Today, just citizens demand that they can conduct business over the Internet. We have over 5,912 participants as of today, including 1,587 Oregon companies that access ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division over the Internet. We offer 28 online service functions at present. We are averaging just over 16,000 transactions per month, and we've concluded over a quarter million transactions since the start of this service in the second quarter of 2003. To give you an idea, one of our most prevalent transactions is the issuance of a weight receipt and a tax identifier. And currently, we're issuing 38% of all of those credentials through our Internet service offering. In commercial vehicle safety, this is the division that is helping truckers comply with state and federal safety rules that apply to vehicles and to drivers. This staff conducts vehicle inspections. This staff conducts driver inspections. This staff conducts safety audits at motor carrier terminals. We also train and certify members of Oregon law enforcement that are involved in the enforcement of Oregon statutes regarding truck safety. We also manage the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Plan, which is a federal grant through which we're expending approximately $2.1 million per year in federal funds, and we are using Oregon State Police as our partners in conducting on-highway truck safety work.
Share with us really quick. In round one, we had brief discussion on the relationship between Department of Transportation and the State Police. And I can't remember how that worked. Is there's a contractual relationship between the two?
Mr. Chairman, there is a contract. OSP is a subcontractor. The Department of Transportation manages a contract. We direct the work, and we hold them accountable for certain outcomes in for the receipt of the dollars that we flow to them. They're paid on a piecemeal rate.
So they're expected then to have a certain number of vehicles inspected over a period of time?
Mr. Chairman, the contract is very straightforward. They're reimbursed on a piecemeal rate. We expect that they'll devote X number of hours over the course of the biennium, and as a result, knowing the average length of time that a transaction takes, we have an expectation of the productivity of the driver and vehicle inspections that will come. And so there's constant communication. They're excellent partners, and I'll detail some very good results later on in the presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Over to mention permits. This division of ODOT issues single-trip permits for exceptionally large or unusual loads, and we also issue continuous operation permits for vehicles that are exceeding legal size and weight limits. In 2003, we processed single-trip permits exceeding 100,000 in number and just under 25,000 in continuous operation trip permits. In size and weight enforcement, we have motor carrier enforcement officers that are based in six districts statewide. They work at six ports of entries, 81 fixed weigh stations, and dozens of portable scale sites that we set up as workload dictates to check trucks and to protect Oregon highways. In 2003, these officers performed manual or static weighings of almost 2.4 million vehicles. And in addition to that, more than 1 million additional vehicles were weighed using our green light system. Now, the green light system is an intelligent transportation system. In essence, the participating trucks have a transponder that looks like this. This is the device. As the trucks approach an automated location, they're automatically weighed, and a variety of tests are made electronically. A truck, I'm giving you a very abbreviated version here for the sake of time, but a truck that is safe and compliant with laws and regulations will get an audio, if the battery were good, would get an audio signal and a green light and be allowed to proceed without stopping at the weigh station.
I think that's an operator error.
It could very well be.
Help me really quick. And so you come, you pull off, or is it scanned as you're just driving down the freeway?
If you've ever noticed, as you're driving I-5 southbound and you're passing by Woodburn, you'll pass over a set of little metal plates right in the roadbed, and you'll also see it looks like a little microwave device suspended over the freeway. When the truck drives over a loop of wire embedded in the concrete, it sets up little inductance, which sends a signal to the automatic vehicle identification device, which sends a query to this transponder and says, in essence, is there a truck there? The truck transponder responds and says, yes, it's Consolidated Freightways transponder number, and as it pulls over those metal plates, that's actually a weigh-in-motion device, and there are hydraulic load cells embedded in the roadway. As the truck is traveling at freeway speeds, that weigh-in-motion device weighs each individual axle, each group of axles, bridge weights, etc. It measures length, and it makes the calculations as to whether or not it's a legal load configuration. By the time it gets to the second AVI device suspended over the freeway, 600 feet down the road, a signal is sent to the truck telling it it may go a green light or it should pull over and stop a red light.
So is that a more cost-effective way to do business?
Mr. Chairman, there's a significant cost avoidance here for the state of Oregon. Today, traffic exceeds the design capacity of most every one of our ports of entry. If we did not use this technology, we would have to add additional lanes, purchase more right-of-way, put in more static scales, hire more staff to deal with the stream of traffic that exceeds the design capacity of scale sites that have been built decades ago.
Do we have those in Eastern Oregon?
Yes, sir, we do. Director Warner suggested I mention savings to the industry, and if it's true that every bypass saves 5 minutes, green light saved truckers almost 86,000 hours of travel time and millions of dollars in truck operating costs during the year. And to give you an idea of the level of participation, there are now over 31,000 trucks in Oregon equipped with these transponders, and we have 3,554 motor carriers that are participating in one level or another with their fleets.
And so, just so I'm clear, so if you're out of compliance, then you're going to get a beep or something, and that tells you you're going to need to pull over.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it will beep audibly in the cab of the truck, and a red light will be displayed, and the driver will have to pull over, park, and bring in his papers.
That's fabulous.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
31,000 trucks, what percent of that is the Oregon truck fleet?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, that's a good question, but let me offer to you that it's really immaterial. What's really material is what percentage of the trucks that are going by an automated site are equipped with transponders. Since not all trucks go by all the automated sites, the second question becomes relevant, and therefore, it just as an illustration, over half of the trucks that get a green that are weighed and sorted at the Woodburn southbound port of entry are weighed and sorted with the green light transponder. In fact, it's more than half. I believe it's 53%.
So the answer to the relevant question then is what?
Enough trucks that would result in more than half of the trucks getting a green light. I don't have a definitive number, but I don't know that it's
tells me what percent pass going by over, you know, using this great technology. My question is, better refined by you, what percent then is 31,000 trucks that have this technology go by the automated system?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it 5%? Is it 95%?
Okay, let me answer your question directly and say if there are 300,000 registered trucks and 31,000 have transponders, 31% say of all trucks operating in Oregon have the transponders in them. And in answer to my question, 53% of the daily truck traffic at the Woodburn southbound scale say 3,500 trucks a day.
I won't belabor the question, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry if I wasn't responsible.
No, you got 10%. You answered my question.
Okay.
10%.
We're going to have you, we're going to need you to come back tomorrow.
Okay.
But let me ask you a question. I'll keep going with this. I come from an ag community. Are those folks who are doing temporary movement of ag product, are they able to come before harvest and come and work with the department to get one of those boxes so that way when they're transporting their products, so long as they're legal, they can just keep on moving?
Mr. Chairman, a farm truck is eligible to participate in the Green Light program.
So I just want to be clear on this. So one of my farmers who's moving potatoes from Hermiston to LeGrand, LeGrand to Hermiston, could be proactive. They could be become part of this program before harvest, and so long as they're operating in compliance, they can move up and down the highway with no problem.
Mr. Chairman, a farm truck is eligible for the Green Light program. The benefit only accrues to them, however, if they're traveling a path on which there is an automated site.
I'm just assuming I-84, well, maybe there's not one of those on I-84, I don't know.
Highway use tax collection, we audit and collect approximately $205 million per year in weight mile tax. We also perform audits required under Oregon's participation in the International Registration Plan and the International Fuel Tax Agreement. We participate in Bay State agreements that have an annual requirement that 3% of all the licensees are subject to audit. In 2003, auditors completed 908 weight mile tax audits, and they recovered in excess of $6 million in unreported taxes and fees.
So let's go back to the Green Light really quick.
Okay.
I'm going to ask that we wrap up on the Green Light program.
Okay.
How does the industry feel about the Green Light program? I see it as a very positive. Would they say the same thing if they were up here?
Mr. Chairman, you would find that Oregon industry loves the Green Light program. It is a huge time saver for them. In fact, they report that it is one of the things that their participation in Green Light is a factor that works to their advantage in driver retainage.
So are you folks doing, what are your plans to expand this?
Mr. Chairman, we're actually automating a new site in Bend on 97 this year, and thereafter it's a question of available funding.
Where does your funding come from? Is this federal money?
Mr. Chairman, the original installation of Greenlight was largely made available by a federal grant. Current installations, including the installation in Bend, are coming out of the highway fund.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Senator Morse.
It's a good program.
It sounds like a good program. It sounds like if you're a legitimate, honest business, this is
it's a good program.
A great program.
And they've got it in Central Oregon, so it's a great program, Mr.
I'm just trying to figure out how we get it on I-84 between Hermiston and LeGrand. we have two more minutes. Anything you'd like to wrap up with until we carry over tomorrow?
I think I would just conclude this particular part of the presentation by saying just a couple of words about economic regulation. The only parts of intrastate motor carriage that are subject to regulation today are household goods and regular out passenger carriage. And our division is responsible for regulating entry, rates, and routes. And our purpose is to make sure that Oregonians have good, stable service at fair prices. I'd stop at that point.
Perfect. Any other comments or thoughts from the committee?
Well,
Senator Westline.
Based on the new information that Bruce Warner is in charge of the batteries in that machine, we determined as a committee it is not operator error, it's Bruce Warner's
fault. Oh.
Seeing no other thoughts or comments before us, we're going to adjourn for the afternoon.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're better, huh?